Life Audio.
Hello, and welcome to Kainos Project.
I'm Dale.
I am Tamara.
And we're here to help you tackle ancient truths in everyday settings. Question for you. Have you ever been told that you have a Jezebel spirit?
Not to my face. I've heard people say that about other women in my presence, but no one has ever told me that I have a Jezebel spirit. That would be quite the insult to say to someone's face. But I think people are very easy to describe someone in that way behind their back. And it's often men, unfortunately.
Yeah, Jezebel and Jezebel spirit is one of those phrases that is used within evangelical circles that really has no reference point outside of the movement. And so it can sound kind of bizarre, but in case you're wondering, Jezebel spirit is not a compliment. Like if someone says that, wow, that woman has a real Jezebel spirit, they're not talking about her tenacity or can do it attitude. It's much more of a derogatory term.
Yeah, they're often referring to her as being like promiscuous or having like this power hungry personality. And those are two interesting ways to interpret it, right? Like if you hear someone say, oh, she has a Jezebel spirit, like, is she scandalous or is she just trying to be in charge? Like those feel like two different things too, but we use the same phrase to describe both of those aspects of a woman.
Right. And this phrase, it finds its origin in the story of a biblical character named Jezebel. So today, I thought that it would be helpful to look at the character of Jezebel, to look at this phrase, Jezebel spirit, and where that came from, what it means. Is that a term that we should be using? You can probably tell from the outset we feel a certain way about it. But we wanted to dive into all the particularities of that. So that's what we're going to do today, but we'll dive into that in just a moment.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with the King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
So today we are talking about Jezebel. Who is she? Why is her spirit so prevalent? And why is that phrase used to refer to a certain type of woman? So let's start with Jezebel's story in the Bible. Now Jezebel, she appears in both 1 and 2 Kings, and she was the daughter of King Ethbaal, who was the king of Tyre and Sidon, which bordered the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, at this point in the story of the Old Testament, the kingdom of Israel, it had split actually into two separate kingdoms. There was Judah in the south with Jerusalem as its capital, and there was the northern kingdom that retained the name Israel, and it had its capital in Samaria. And so this king of Tyre and Sidon, he's in the kingdom just bordering the northern kingdom of Israel. And his name was Ethbaal. And with that name, you might have guessed that he was a prophet of Baal. And Baal was an ancient fertility god. So it was believed that he controlled like the rain and the crops. And so if you wanted to get your food in an agrarian society, you needed to keep him happy. And the ways to keep him happy were quite bizarre to the modern mind, because you needed to sacrifice infant children on altars of stone that would be heated with fire, and these poor infants would be killed. And also part of the ritualistic worship of Baal was all kinds of weird sexual stuff, like weird sex orgies and all that kind of jazz. But it was kind of standard fare for a lot of fertility gods at the time. So Jezebel, she was the daughter of King Ethbaal, and so she was raised up in that tradition. And she actually brought it with her when she got married to King Ahab in that northern kingdom, and she moved to the northern kingdom. And so that northern kingdom of Israel started to incorporate, you know, all the practices of Baal worship. And even more than just like incorporating them alongside whatever worship they had to Yahweh, she was actually on this mission to get rid of Yahweh worship in the northern kingdom. And so she started persecuting all of the prophets of God that were there in Israel. She killed some of them, and then there were many others that fled into hiding, trying to get away from Jezebel. And so this is what brought her into direct conflict with the prophet Elijah. And if you grew up going to Sunday school, you probably know this story of this epic showdown between Elijah and Ahab and Jezebel and all the prophets of Baal, where they go up to Mount Carmel and they have this showdown where they have two altars, and Elijah's going to pray to his God to bring fire down and light that altar, and the prophets of Baal would do the same. At the end of the day, the prophets of Baal lost that showdown. Their altar did not, you know, light when they called out to Baal. But Elijah's God, Yahweh, our God, lit the fire on Elijah's altar.
Yeah, it's a really good story, especially when Elijah is getting pretty arrogant about it. And he like puts water on his altar and like just adds all of these extra measures of, see, like, there's no trickery here on my end. Like, this is just how great my God is. Like, he's going to light this altar, and I'm going to make sure it's like soaking wet so he can still do it.
Yeah, and he even was taunting the prophets of Baal. He's like, well, maybe your God is on a trip. Maybe he can't
maybe
hear
he's
you.
Sleeping.
Maybe he's sleeping. Maybe he's going to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and keep calling. But he never answered, because Baal is not a real God.
Right.
And Elijah's God, who is the God of Israel, who is our God, is real. And the fire is lit. And so it's this epic victory over the prophets of Baal. And so it's a pretty devastating loss for Jezebel. And from that moment on, she pretty much vows to capture Elijah and murder him, and sends him on the run. And she held this grudge pretty much to the end of her life, where if she saw Elijah, she was going to get him killed somehow. She was never successful, but she took that grudge with her to her grave. And then we see her in another account where she just acted as a violent, wicked ruler. There was this other account of when Ahab, he wanted to buy this land that was directly next to his palace so that he could kind of expand his palatial estate. And the guy that owned it was this guy named Naboth, and he wouldn't sell it to Ahab because he had inherited that land. And according to Jewish law, you couldn't just sell your inheritance like that. And so he was trying to honor God's law by not selling it to Ahab. But Ahab was upset about that. Jezebel got mad about it. And so she had Naboth killed and took the land anyway. So she's just this really, you know, conniving and evil ruler. And eventually she did meet her own demise in a very violent fashion. After the death of Ahab, Ahab's son takes over, but he's eventually deposed and killed by Jehu, who takes the throne. And Jehu is the one who ends up having Jezebel killed in a pretty brutal fashion. She gets tossed out of a window, and then when she hits the floor, her blood splatters and it hits some horses, and so they get riled up and she gets trampled by the horses. Then after that, her body is eaten by dogs until there's like nothing left but like her skull and like the palms of her hands. And this was actually the fulfillment of a prophecy that came from the lips of none other than Elijah. And it said this: In the territory of Jezreel, the dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be as dung on the face of the field in the territory of Jezreel, so that no one can say, this is Jezebel. So, that is the story of Jezebel.
If you ever think the Bible's boring.
Right.
Like, these are those stories that are, like, it feels like they're tucked and buried into the Old Testament, but they really are, like, very interesting and... If not that this is all that they are, but entertaining as well.
Right, yeah.
Like, they're really good stories to
This
read.
Is very much a quintessential Old Testament narrative right. story. And so that's Jezebel. She was oppressive. She was evil. She was vindictive. She was bloodthirsty. And because there's a couple mentions of her appearance in the narrative, because she was adorned like a queen as any queen would be, because there's reference to that, there's often this implication that she was also promiscuous in some way. And so mixed in with her, you know, bloodthirstiness was just this kind of promiscuity that was also associated with her as this powerful woman who also happened to be evil.
I don't know if the original readers would have taken it that way, though, because she was just like a queen of her day in terms of her attire.
Yeah, and I think right. the place where it's mentioned specifically is right before her death, where she had painted her face and she had adorned herself as any queen would, kind of showing her arrogance that she thought that she was going to continue right. to reign. And then she, you know, proceeds to get thrown out of a window and dishonored pretty terribly in her death. And so I think that's more what the Old Testament writers were kind of trying to illustrate by mentioning her appearance. But yeah, that's kind of her story. She is mentioned in the New Testament, but only once as this sort of like emblem of the evil things that Queen Jezebel kind of stood for and embodied in that Old Testament account. And that mention comes in Revelation 2:20, which is part of a specific address to the church in a city called Thyatira. And the book of Revelation is really addressed to seven churches in what is modern-day Turkey. And in the opening chapters of Revelation, they kind of get a status report on all these churches. So John writes to them, and Jesus kind of gives them a message. What's going good? What's going not so good in your churches? There was a lot of not-so-good stuff going on in those churches, and Thyatira was one of them. So let me read to you the only New Testament reference to Jezebel that exists, and it comes in Revelation 2 verses 19 through 23, I read. And so this is Jesus talking to the church in Thyatira. He says, I know your works, your love and faith and service and patience and endurance, and that your latter works exceed your first. So far, so good. But then it kind of takes a turn. But this I have against you, that you tolerate that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, and is teaching and seducing my servants to practice sexual immorality and to eat food sacrificed to idols. I gave her time to repent, but she refuses to repent of her sexual immorality. Behold, I will throw her onto a sickbed, and those who commit adultery with her I will throw into great tribulation, unless they repent of her works, and I will strike her children dead. And all the churches will know that I am he who searches the mind and heart, and I will give to each according to your works. So, not a sterling depiction of Jezebel in this passage. And so there was apparently some kind of pagan prophetess in Thyatira who was leading some Christians astray. And it's not likely that her name was actually Jezebel. The book of Revelation is like very symbolic in drawing on Old Testament images and pictures and words that would kind of draw your mind back to the imagery of the Old Testament. And Jezebel's, you know, what everybody knew was this evil leader who was kind of a terror. And so this is where that idea of spirit of Jezebel comes from, Jezebel's spirit, someone of the ilk of Jezebel, even though the text never actually uses the phrase Jezebel's spirit. That's kind of an extra biblical phrase that came along after to kind of describe this. And it may not have even been like this singular woman in the church. It could have been a group of women or a group of men and women. But in the highly coded language of Revelation, it's this symbolism of what Jezebel was emblematic of in the Old Testament narrative. And so the problem in Thyatira was that apparently they had been engaging in some pagan practices of whatever local fertility god was the fertility god of that time and in that place. And so they may have been eating food that was sacrificed to idols in a way that was kind of endorsing that idol worship, even though they picked it up in the marketplace. Maybe they were engaging in some of these ritual worship practices. They were maybe getting into some of those weird sexual rituals and things like that. And it's actually quite possible that they were doing that just to remain like members of the community. Like, instead of completely breaking away from the culture around them and becoming like these ostracized weirdos, they probably had one foot in these old practices so that they could remain kind of members of the community in good standing. Because if you're not worshiping the local fertility god, don't you care if it rains? That's kind of like the what the cultural feeling was at the time. And so John, in the words of Jesus here, are kind of calling back to the same thing that Ahab did in the Old Testament, in that he is king of this nation at a point in world history where being a king was a very volatile thing. And so he had to make some very strategic, diplomatic and military decisions and alliances so that he could secure the borders of his nation. And one of those was marrying Jezebel. And keeping Jezebel happy by importing all of the practices of this pagan worship, and by doing that, creating a stronger alliance with the king of Tyre and Sidon. And so that's kind of the parallel there, that these people are trying not to lose their place in society, and so they're engaging in these things that are pagan worship. That's what was happening in the Old Testament with Ahab and Jezebel. And so that's kind of the teaching from Revelation that that Jesus is addressing through John. And so that is really the limited range of meaning of Jezebel's spirit in the New Testament. And again, the phrase Jezebel's spirit doesn't even appear as such. That's more just kind of like how we describe what occurred in that city as we kind of provide commentary to that passage.
Yeah, and the phrase has really leaped away from what we see in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament. And even as you're talking about what Jesus is saying, or really the rebuke that he's saying to the church in Revelation, it's just that reminder of the pagan background that Jezebel came from, right? With her dad being the fertility god. So,
or the prophet of the fertility god. He wasn't the fertility god himself.
Yeah, no, of course, sorry. The prophet of the fertility god, but that was very much part of her, like her world. That was who she was in many ways, was the way that she was brought up. And then, of course, her marrying into Israel, being the wife of the king, she brought all of that baggage with her. And all throughout the Old Testament, you see a lot of the influence of who the king married, then those gods that woman served were like intermingled with the other traditions within Israel itself.
Right. And it was always kind of part of this strategic alliance building with bordering
with other
kingdoms,
nations, right,
so that you could secure your place as the king and not be taken out at some point, which is, again, in the New Testament, the teaching of, you know, they're doing the same thing by kind of creating strategic alliances with their community by embracing some of these practices, even though these practices are idolatrous and in many times they were evil and immoral. They were doing that because it was strategic to do so, and to not do that would take an incredible measure of faith and kind of a willingness to break away from the world around you in many ways.
Yeah, because at that point, God was calling Israel to be different, right? In the way that they managed their kingdom and the way that they interacted with the neighboring nations. And it wasn't follow what the rest of the kings are doing, which is building these marriage alliances so that way they can have greater protection from the border nations and greater protection from their enemies. It was very, very strategic. And just in history in general, we see marriage used a lot that way. It might probably still use that way in other countries, right? So this idea of Jezebel being a like pagan worshiper and bringing her influence into Israel is not unique to her.
Right, but she would just, but like, she did it the best, you know? Like, she was the most notorious character in the Old Testament that was associated with this. But really, she was acting like any pagan royal person would act at that time.
Yeah.
It just so happened that she was a high-profile woman.
And I so think we even read that in, what, Solomon and all of his wives?
Right.
Right? Like, there's sections where we're reading about Solomon. And some of the great grievances against him is that he's letting all of his wives and concubines, like, bring about their rituals and their pagan practices into Israel, setting up their altars and their gods. And so there's just, like, a ton of different gods being worshipped in Israel now because of the influence of the king's wives.
Right.
So I think I'm bringing this up to make get clear that this was not unique to Jezebel. It was unique in what she brought in and the way she brought in these influences, and unique in the way that she was pretty power hungry and pretty forthright about her pagan worship being the way of Israel versus one of the gods that was worshipped.
Right. I think she's unique in that the way that she was portrayed as being a pretty key player in that narrative, in a way that, you know, Solomon's wives, we don't even know, you know, their names, all of these wives that brought in these pagan deities. And they certainly, there's no evidence that they were agents of persecution for worship of the one true God. So that's why she becomes this symbol of this kind of foreign agent coming into the church and corrupting it by bringing in the pagan practices of the world, many of which are immoral and wrong. And so that's who Jezebel is. And really, that's what it means to have a Jezebel spirit in the way that the New Testament is using it. But the way that that phrase is used currently in evangelicalism is much different than that very kind of grounded narrative that we just explored. But I want to dive into that in just a minute. So we just looked at Jezebel and who she was in the Old Testament, and the one New Testament reference, the one and only New Testament reference of her, that kind of calls back to this idea that to have the spirit of Jezebel is to compromise with the world and allow immoral pagan practices to come into our own practice, because it's pragmatic, because it is strategic in some ways to do that, so that you can forego some kind of pain or danger or uncertainty. And so that's the way the New Testament uses Jezebel as an example in that one instance. But the way that Christians use Jezebel as an example today, many times in the evangelical church, has broadened pretty widely from that initial use, and it pretty much is used to describe any kind of powerful or influential woman that those particular people using the term Jezebel spirit don't like. And so also for, like, people who are, like, more in charismatic movements, a spirit of Jezebel, they've, like, actually, like, upgraded this to, like a personified spirit. Like, they talk about the spirit of Jezebel. Like, there is a demon out there named Jezebel who acts in a very specific way. I think that's a narrower subset of people who would use this phrase, but that is out there.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in a charismatic background, I definitely never heard it used quite like that.
Yeah, in my readings.
I heard it used often, but not like that.
Yeah, in my readings, I was, like, trying to figure out, like, what do people think about the spirit of Jezebel? And a lot of what I was reading from more charismatic sources were kind of this more personified vision of a spirit, a literal spirit of Jezebel. But more often than not, it's used more as kind of like a type of person, particularly a type of woman acting in a particular kind of way.
I have never heard the spirit of Jezebel be used for a man.
Right.
So this is, I mean, maybe to say 100% of its use is only for women might not be accurate. But again, in all of my, like, time of hearing people use this phrase, I've never heard a man be called, like, oh, he has a Jezebel spirit. Instead, he's just a really strong leader.
Right, yeah. So this phrase is usually used to describe a woman, usually an attractive woman, who is perceived to be trying to like manipulate or control other people or gain some type of influence in the church or over church leadership, and usually kind of doing that by means of some kind of seduction. And the purpose of gaining that control is to spread, some kind of false doctrine, usually of the feminist variety. And it's also believed that, you know, Jezebel thrives in situations where male leaders are kind of weak and passive and easily manipulated. So in short, in the common parlance of today, a Jezebel is basically a sexy woman who is trying to take control of leadership in the church for her own ends. So that's kind of how it's used today. You either die the smoking hot wife or you live long enough to become the Jezebel spirit.
Oh gosh, the smoking hot wife. Why has that become a phrase among pastors in the Christian church? It's so icky. Sorry.
There's always that weird moment too. Is that at this point, say like, my smoking hot wife, and then everybody in the room like looks over
and the like, what are you looking at her
like,
for?
I don't know about smoking hot. If that's how I would,
right? Yeah. Like, why is that the way that
like we're all looking like how smoking hot? Like we're just like gosh, like why are you even like taking us? Like, this preach the Bible. Stop doing this weird stuff.
I mean, you can honor your wife in such a way that doesn't require her to be
smoking
the
hot,
hottest wife in the room, unless. That is what makes you a good wife, maybe.
Right.
Like, you're a good wife because you're smoking hot.
Yeah, but that's kind of like the characterization of, like, you know, the smoking hot wife is like the woman objectified in a good way. And then the Jezebel is the woman objectified in a bad way.
Right.
And so for you, and like having heard this phrase kind of in your upbringing a lot and seeing it mostly used towards women and, you know, typically attractive women, where do you see like the overlap between like this use of Jezebel's spirit and like purity culture of the last, you know, whatever, 30 years?
I've actually seen this most often used, I guess, with younger women when it comes to the way that they're dressed. So it's not so much that they're even in a position to be assertive and powerful in leadership, right? It's just often like, don't dress like a Jezebel. And it ends up being within that, like, modest is hottest. And I think that might have been like a really old episode that we did, but
right.
Just the way that it intersects is really troubling, because again, it goes back to the objectification of women, and now we're measuring them and their character and their personality and who they are simply by how they're dressed, and then giving them this harsh label. Because like you just unpacked, Jezebel was not a good person. Like, she was no hero in the Bible. You never read anything good about her. And so to instantly be a woman that's called a Jezebel merely by how she's dressed, I think it just continues to perpetuate the cycle of the objectification of women and of only letting women be viewed through such a lens as based on their physical appearance.
Yeah, and I think so this intersects with like purity culture, and I think it also intersects with like a vision for like hyper complementarianism. So not every form of complementarianism is kind of going to be like this. I think there are visions for complementarity that are upholding of women in a way that's not like this. But there is a significant movement within complementarity and like a hyper complementarity, where if a woman is, you know, shows shoulder and also she has some leadership capability, or she has like a strong personality, or she can communicate clearly, or she's not afraid to kind of speak truth to power, or she has gifts that, you know, people will rally around her, or she's a good teacher, or she's, you know, a compelling person, you know, and people gravitate towards her, that kind of upsets the vision for kind of a quiet, submissive woman who's barefoot and pregnant and doesn't speak a word outside of her house, And so, like, if you are breaking that mold in any way, like, that's a Jezebel. And so to use such a strong, like, one of the worst, probably the worst female villain in the entire Bible.
Right.
To label that person who is really just kind of, you know, stepping into their personality and their giftings and navigating through that to kind of stamp that out because it doesn't fit into this very specific mold of a hyper complementarity, that's an easy way to do it because no one wants to be a Jezebel. That's like being a Judas.
Right.
It's like,
well, and what's so interesting is when you hear the how common this phrase is used. I don't think it's as common anymore as it was for maybe previous generations.
It definitely had a moment, and I think that moment is,
I think it's gone. I've heard it used recently about a woman, and I think that's where this conversation actually started. Like, I came home and told you about, like, someone who referred to a woman as that Jezebel. And I just got so upset. Like, I just, on behalf of all, like, Christian women who are just, like, capable women who, like, enjoy working and, like, that's just what they want to do. Like, for us to all just be labeled as Jezebels just because we're not, like, living a different kind of life that fits a certain mold is just really infuriating to me. Maybe I have been called a Jezebel, just never to my face. So, likely behind my back, and that's okay. But I think just going back to this understanding of this insult, really, it's meant to be used as an insult. It's not meant to be used as, like, an encouragement. Like, oh, you have such a David spirit.
Right.
Right? Like, to be called a Jezebel is just an insult. And the going back to what I was trying to say originally is you kind of see those parallels. Like, men are often called, like, David, right? Like, they'll be referenced to David and
right.
His heart. Oh, he has a heart for the Lord. And, you know, he's just a real David leading his team. And but if it's a woman who maintains those exact same characteristics, she's a Jezebel.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Christian way of calling someone the B word. Like, if
yes.
there is
yes.
a strong man who comes on strong, he's a little bit aggressive, he's a little bit confrontational, say, wow, he has some leadership.
He has great leadership skills, and he's assertive, and he has a strong personality, and, like, maybe he's not kind through it, but that's okay. Like, he's in the position he's in because he has those capabilities within him. But if you have a woman who comes on that way,
in the secular world, she's a B word. But right. since we're good Christians, we can't say that. We call her Jezebel.
We call her Jezebel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And God forbid she dress nice. Like, she just is fashionable as well. Then she's for sure a Jezebel.
Right. Yeah. I think, it's kind of like this weird, like, underlying, like, sexual thing that kind of tells on the person who's, like, using that phrase of, like, here's this powerful woman who's, like, attractive. Oh, like, I hate myself for, like, being attracted to, like, this powerful woman, so I have to, like, portray her as evil. She's a temptress. She's
right.
she's a provocateur. And so
yeah.
she needs to be stamped out because I have, you know,
right.
weird sexual feelings towards her.
Well, and I don't even know if it goes that far, but it might for some people. But just the fact that she's wearing something that's relatively form-fitting, like, it actually, like, fits her body. And she's not walking around in a potato sack, like, then she must be a Jezebel. Because how dare her wear something that fits her? Like,
right.
I don't even think it means that she has to be dressed, like, provocatively. She just, it can be as simple as, you know, she wore a pencil skirt. Like, that's a style. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Ah, like, you saw her waist. Oh, my goodness. She must be a Jezebel.
Right. Yeah.
So I think what just frustrates me the most is often the double standard, right, among men and women, where if you see the exact same characteristic traits of a man, then he is he's this equipped, powerful leader. And if you see those characteristic traits in a woman being exercised, then she's this evil spirit, also known as Jezebel.
Right. Yeah. And you mentioned that this phrase, it was kind of pretty prominent in the local church for a period of time, and it probably still is in some circles. But I've recently seen it kind of resurgent, not so much to talk about other kind of Christian leaders within the church, but actually to talk about political leaders. And there's this one very specific example. It's actually what brought this conversation to my mind recently. I was scrolling through Twitter and I saw this clip of a podcast that was being promoted between Mark Driscoll and Sean Foyt. So Mark Driscoll is Mark Driscoll, like, you know, the whole Mars Hill, abusive leadership. That church basically imploded, and so he moved to Arizona, and he planted another church that is very much doing a lot of the same kind of stuff. Then you have Sean Foyt, who's kind of part of this charismatic side of things. He originally was with Bethel Church, but now he's kind of an independent worship leader, songwriter, author. He was a part of, like, in 2020, those, like, protest worship gatherings, where mm-hmm. it's like COVID restrictions or Christian persecution. And so what they did at the height of the pandemic is they went into urban areas and without masks and laid their hands on people experiencing homelessness and prayed over them in the middle of a pandemic and did all that kind of stuff. And so, there, you know, it's very much like this like military macho kind of Christianity that is being displayed in this conversation with them. But they actually use this phrase, and I wanted to play this clip for you of this, the kind of soundbite that they pulled from the podcast to kind of promote it.
In Israel, you've got Ahab,
right,
who is a passive king, but he's good at military and money. Jezebel, who's his demonic, seductive, high control, evil wife. And the question is, do these spirits still work today? Are there men who are passive and women who are controlling?
Is that a rhetorical question?
In government, in politics. Yeah. And like you look at the White House, you're like, okay, let's just hypothetically say that there was an ancient government led by a passive man who really was overrun by a domineering, high-controlling woman who slept her way to the top. That's what happened in Israel. And you're like, wonder if that would ever happen
very
again.
Very contemporary. It's a very contemporary example.
I'm just asking questions and throwing out connections.
Wow.
You know.
So that was Mark Driscoll talking about none other than the president and vice president. And this is rhetoric that he's not the only one who's been doing this. Kind of in the run-up to the 2020 election, there was a lot of this where Kamala Harris, who is the first vice president of the United States, who is a woman, and first vice president who is a person of color, that was a very historic, significant thing. But those who were opposed to the party platform of Joe Biden, some of them for, you know, legitimate reasons, had a very illegitimate way of expressing that that came across, you know, pretty misogynistically. And so in a lot of circles, Kamala Harris got this moniker of Jezebel. And so there was this one high profile kind of SBC pastor who, in response to kind of this, you know, this kind of growing conversation about Kamala Harris being a role model for young women of color, because of what she's been able to accomplish, he tweeted this out. He says, quote, "I can't imagine any truly God-fearing Israelite who would have wanted their daughters to view Jezebel as an inspiring role model because she was a woman in power," end quote. And then there were other pastors and preachers who, from their pulpit, who on social media, in, you know, videos and wherever they were referring to Kamala Harris as Jezebel Harris. And so, having listened to that clip and, you know, all of that background, like, what do you make of this? Like, what are the implications of referring to the first woman to become the vice president of the United States as Jezebel?
I think I have a lot of thoughts on that, and none of them are good. So I'm just trying to really parse out I share and not
what is
just, like,
appropriate for mass consumption that is floating through my brain.
Yeah, and it's not just out words that are shared out of just anger.
Even in that clip, the way that was like, there's like rock music. Women suck. It's like so weird.
Well, and what's so unfortunate is that this term is used by men who are often just threatened by any kind of leadership role a woman takes on. Now, in regards to the vice president, I think Like, that's different in so far as they're speaking specifically to her, right? Still an insult. Like, why would you say that? But, and also the reference that they had in that clip of like Jezebel sleeping her way to the top.
Right. That's not exactly a good biblical exposition of what happened.
That's not biblical exposition at all. And then you're just like throwing these blanket statements out of a woman who is in power must be sleeping her way to the top. Like, how are we treating women any better than the world is treating them?
Well, we're treating them worse.
Throwing these phrases, we're treating them worse. But by throwing these phrases around and wrapping them up in biblical language and saying, well, this is a godly discerning thing that I'm doing by calling you a Jezebel. Like, I am so certain that the original authors did not share this aspect of Israel's history with us so that we can leverage it and utilize it against all women who step into any kind of a leadership role. Yeah, I mean, you can have your beef with the vice president, you can have your beef with the president, and you can say what you want to say, but to wrap it in biblical language and like call out somebody in this way, I think is a complete like misuse of scripture, first of all. And it's just, there's also an arrogance about it, right?
Yeah.
To like throw it out like, oh, she's a Jezebel, blah, 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 blah. She's like, oh my goodness, people. Like, can we can have opinions on people, but we don't have to all of a sudden justify them by using biblical characters.
Right.
Because then that person seems holy. Like, oh, I'm discerning you have this spirit about you that we read about in scripture. No, you're kind of just being a jerk and you don't like the person.
Right. And yeah, it's wild because I don't endorse the Biden administration. I think in a lot of ways I didn't vote for Biden. I didn't vote for the other side either, but I didn't vote for Biden. I haven't publicly supported him. In many ways, I've been, you know, disappointed with the way that his administration has gone thus far. But like, I can still appreciate the fact that Kamala Harris is a historically significant individual for what she has accomplished. And there's no reason for like an ad hominem attack that is really wrapped in pretty misogynistic inclinations and then wrap that in biblical language. Like, that's just off the table, you know, like that's and you're not even addressing like any kind of real thing that's going on. Yeah. Like, I don't like this administration because of this policy stance or because of that policy stance or because of this vision for this way to run the country, which is what, you know, I'm fine with that. Like, I might agree with a lot of critiques coming from Christians in that regard, but to call her a Jezebel, absolutely not. That's just uncalled for. That is unchristlike.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. There were no comments about anything specific to her other than the fact that, based on their analysis, Biden is a weak man, Kamala Harris is a strong woman, therefore she's a Jezebel.
Right.
And I mean, the weak man part is probably an insult too, but you notice he doesn't get any names, right? Like, he doesn't get any classifications of the kind of man he is other than like he has weak leadership.
Right.
But she has, you know, this element of strong leadership. And I don't know if they're trying to infer as well that she slept her way to the top, which is another like, wow, I can't believe you're trying to suggest that either. But therefore she gets this very weighty label within the Christian evangelical world of a Jezebel. As soon as you say that name, people say like a ton of things already populate into their mind about what you're describing this person as, versus to describe the president as a weak leader. Like, that's just what it is.
Well, it's interesting because in that metaphor, he would be Ahab, who Ahab was not a weak leader.
No.
Particularly by the world. Like, he was a warrior. He was a strategist. He was a diplomat. He was being very proactive. It's just the things that he was being proactive in were wrong and evil, but he wasn't weak. He was wrong, but he wasn't weak. And so even just the exposition of the biblical narrative is askew, and it skews in a way that betrays some assumptions that are misogynistic, like pretty frankly misogynistic. So when it comes to this phrase, Jezebel or Jezebel spirit, do you think that there's any way that it could be used in a way that is not inherently problematic?
If we started over and it had no baggage, maybe, right? Because really what Jezebel was doing is she was leading the people of God away from God and turning them over to these like pagan ideologies and really changing the way of the culture. And because she was someone in leadership, she was able to do that on just like a mass scale. And so I think that has to do with a lot more of her not being a follower of God, someone who submits herself to the Lord and wants to seek like his goodness in the world. And I think that in many ways, her character could have been male or female in terms of what the Bible is really trying to address by bringing her to the forefront of the narrative, right? Like her gender doesn't change why the Bible is calling her out.
Does, right.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if we could start over and maybe use this phrase, then maybe, and you could really use it for any kind of a person, male or female. But I think we have just taken it to a point that it no longer matches what the biblical narrative was trying to show us through the character of Jezebel and the harm that she did to the people of God and the way that they were persuaded by her. So yeah, I don't think we should use it at all.
Yeah.
Moving forward. Like, I think we just need to like purge it from our vocabulary.
Right. I think from our common vocabulary. I think the only time it would be permissible to use it in a way that wouldn't be problematic is if you are preaching a sermon on Revelation chapter 2, beginning in verse 19. You know what I mean? Like, and in a very specific way that's actually addressing the concerns that are being presented in that text, which have nothing to do with Kamala Harris, and she's not even part of the conversation or even in the neighborhood of that same conversation, because, yeah, it's addressing something completely different than that. And so I think if you use it in that very narrow context, which is the only context the New Testament uses it, that's, you know, still be careful. But and maybe you don't even use the word Jezebel spirit. Like, maybe you just, like, find a different way to phrase that because, yeah, this phrase has so much baggage. And I think it's just so important for us in just all of the vernacular that we use as in the Christianese or whatever you might call it, to not use words or phrases that are from the Bible in a way that really goes beyond the intent of what the biblical authors were trying to say. Like with Jezebel's spirit, we've gone completely, you know, left field of what the biblical authors were trying to convey in telling her story, and then that one verse referencing her kind of as emblematic of an issue that was going on in this local church. I think there's a lot of phrases that, you know, we could examine and say, like, yeah, we don't use that in a way that is in line with what the biblical idea was and also is problematic in some ways. And then we're wrapping our problematic assumptions in biblical language, and that's just a recipe for disaster, you know. So I think, yeah, this one's got to go in terms of like, in terms of like phrases that we use. I mean, we can keep for such a time as this, so long as we know that we're being a little bit ironic with it. There, we can say I'm blessed and highly favored when we get a shake from Chick-fil-A because, you know, that's kind of tongue in cheek and fun. But Jezebel's spirit, that one's on the chopping block, and we probably shouldn't use that one anymore because it's not a term that builds anyone up. It's not a term that can be used in a way that's even humorous or fun or lighthearted. It's just a mean phrase.
Or even in a way that is like correcting. Right?
Or it's not instructive.
It's
even.
Not constructive in, because there can be aspects where not always do the words we use need to be like sunshine and rainbows, right? But there's a place to have conversations with people and, yeah, call out some areas of their personality or their actions or their characteristics that are helpful and constructive and even edifying them to become more like Christ, right? But to use this kind of a phrase, there's zero benefit of it. It's only an insult, which is why anytime I hear somebody say it, there's a lot of other words I want to say to them afterwards, but I don't. And that's probably good because they'd probably just label me as a Jezebel anyways. So
they already have. Don't even worry about
they
it.
They already have. Yeah. So again, this is just not a term to use. And if you have used it in the past, like, you don't have to beat yourself up, but maybe just never use it ever again.
Thanks for listening to the Kynos Project podcast. Thank you also to our partners at Life Audio. Visit lifeaudio.com to find dozens of other faith-centered podcasts in the network, including shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more. If you enjoyed hanging out with us today, consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a rating and review. And be sure to visit our website, kynosproject.com, for more helpful resources. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Looking for ways to stay positive? Brighten your day with the free Story Behind podcast. Hear weekly short stories that showcase true joy, love, and hope. Listen now at lifeaudio.com or by searching for Story Behind wherever you get your podcasts.